Welcome to Principal Center Radio, bringing you the best in professional practice. Here's your host, director of the Principal Center and champion of high performance instructional leadership, Justin Bader.
Welcome everyone to Principal Center Radio. I'm Justin Bader, and my guest today is Don Wetrick. Don is innovation coordinator at Noblesville High School and the author of Pure Genius, Building a Culture of Innovation and Taking 20% Time to the Next Level.
And now, our feature presentation.
Don, welcome to Principal Center Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Justin.
So tell us a little bit about your path as an educator and how the idea of 20% time came into your world.
I was actually in the business world for the first 2 or 3 years out of college, and I caught the bug. I promised myself I wouldn't be in education because everybody else in my family was, including my sister. And I would just go to bed at night not liking what I was doing because I saw the influence my dad had on people and my sister was enjoying her life. And I always remember that moment where I told my dad and mom, who they paid for every cent of my education, that I was going to go back and get my teaching license. And always remember this. My dad took a long pause. And it reminds you, he had paid for every cent of my education. And he says, you know, Don, I don't care if you go on to teach for the next 20 years. Please don't teach 1 year 20 times. And that kind of got me started. And it always has left an impact on me in that I don't want the same thing to happen year after year. So I think this is year 18 of my career. And the how I got here to the innovation coordinator, it's odd. I taught middle school English. I then taught broadcasting and documentary filmmaking, as well as some English. And then I remember the moment, and I remember where I was sitting. I had a friend of mine email me and said, have you seen the Daniel Pink TED Talk? And this is where a lot of 20% time Genius Hour people are probably nodding their head and laughing, because everybody had this moment where we listened to Dan and you kind of went, I can do that in school. And that's exactly what we did. I went and I think the next day I showed it to my class and you know, had them say, you know, what do you think? What do you think of this concept? And, you know, things were thrown out like, yeah, finally a class I get to enjoy, or yeah, about time we get to do stuff we really wanted to do. And so I decided then and there, and it didn't really have a name yet. Genius Hour, 20% time. Well, I guess 20% time had been taken, but in the ed circles, we just, you know, gave it a go. So the next week, I opened up this time and space for everybody to learn what they're passionate about. And then I quickly learned that a lot of educators, myself included, have done a really good job of training students to wait for instructions. And when the instructions are, hey, let's find out things that you're passionate about and let's work around that, well, that's out of their realm. So it was a rocky start, that's for sure. And that's kind of what inspired me to write the book. I didn't give up on it. It's been a long and winding road, that's for sure. But I think now more than ever, we're starting to look at our economy. We're starting to look at the jobs that aren't even created yet, but we know what they aren't. That all of a sudden, innovation and creativity and design thinking in some ways are starting to be looked at and taken a little bit more seriously. And I think it's a great time to be a student, and I think it's a great time to start looking at innovation.
So let's talk about some kind of defining characteristics and parameters on the 20% time idea, which I think comes from Google. Is that right? They have a day a week set aside for their employees to work on kind of passion projects?
Yeah, I mean, I guess quoting Dan Pink's talk, I mean, Atlassian was one of the first to start it. But yeah, Google was notoriously, or probably the most popular example where, yes, they basically gave you 1 day a week to work on projects that you deemed necessary, and then you had to glean or, you know, produce data on what your findings were. And that's absolutely what a lot of 20% time people do.
And I think that we've seen some tremendous innovations. And if I recall correctly, I think even Gmail was one of those projects, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Among a lot of other things. Yes.
So within a class period or within a secondary subject area, do you put any parameters on that? Do you say, all right, this is a high school history class or this is a high school English class, so 80% of the time we're going to focus on the curriculum and the other 20% of the time you get to pursue something that you're interested related to this subject, or is it more open than that?
Well, so I guess I'll answer that in two different ways. Genius Hour 20% time model, yes, that is usually the case. I, however, struck gold in the sense that I asked my superintendent and principal 4 years back, hey, could I make this its own class? And they chuckled and they said, I don't see a Daniel Pink course description in the state approved catalog. But undeterred, I looked for course catalog descriptions that were vague. And I'm not saying this to in a mean way, but I wanted to look for a loophole. And I guess our first innovation in innovations class is I found a course description that was called group discussions. And in the description, you know, students gather data, formulate opinions, and have dialogue in a group setting. And I'm like, you know what? That works. So, because, you know, I do a fair amount of going around and talking about these things, and that's always the first question. Hands go up. How in the heck did you get this class approved? And it's funny because I more or less said, hey, can I do this? And they took a chance, and I'm really grateful that they did. And it's obviously more than just group discussions, but that's how we got started. The basic parameters of my class is, you know, basically if you had that 20% time every day of the week. Now, here's where it gets confusing to some people because they're like, okay, so what do you do to sit around and wait for inspiration? Essentially, the way my class is structured is that, like a lot of, you know, PBL work, we normally have a driving question. But it doesn't have to be in my area of expertise. I mean, I taught English and TV broadcasting. Most of my projects don't have any of those things. Well, you know, sometimes they do, but my students basically look at things that they have an interest in. You know, I wrote not too long ago, does school get in the way of learning? You know, essentially, if my student really wanted to learn something and they had a project they wanted to work on, that's the class for them. This is the place to do it. So they start off with a driving question. They write a proposal. A lot of times a good project is anywhere between 3 to 5 weeks. So in their proposal, they tell me what they're going to do. They have to look for outside collaborators. And this is, I think, a key element. When we look for mentors, we find some of the best people out there. A lot of times through social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, things of that nature, they get firm commitments from these people. And then they tell me they're going to, you know, when they're going to collaborate with them, what their project's going to look like. I actually have them do research on the Common Core standards. And they tell me what standards they think they're going to master through this project. And then they go through a proposal period where I look at it. They have a pitch day, much like a TED talk. The students themselves, we get together and we try to help brainstorm to them potential problems that they may have. And then once that's all over, I either give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. If I give it a thumbs up, I hold them to their calendar. They tell me it's going to take 5 weeks. It, you know, I give them some wiggle room, but it normally does. And so from there, any day of, you know, a lot of times on Monday we get together and brainstorm, but, you know, Tuesday through Friday, they're collaborating with, they're working on their own projects. And then by the time it's done, and this is what I really like about this, they self-assess. You know, in their proposal, they tell me how many points it's probably going to be worth, because I do have a rubric, but I also have a minimum amount of points you need for an A, B, C, D at the end of the semester. So at the end of the project, they say, hey, I deserve a, you know, 20 points, 30 points, 40, whatever. And then they substantiate it to me based on the standards they've mastered, the people they've collaborated with, the takeaways they've had. And I found this to be a more authentic assessment than anything I've ever had before, because when a student tells me I deserve a 40, you know, points for this, and I go, oh, no, you deserve a 20. If they argue and clearly lay out the reasons why, that is way more authentic than me subjectively saying, 20 points. So I love that aspect of it. And the other thing, the other takeaway I've loved so far is that these people they're working with are not only great people in their areas, but they're potential job leads later on. They're collaborators that they can work with for who knows how long. And it's been a really, really fun journey to work with some of these collaborators all over the world.
So Don, can you describe for us a little bit the structure of your innovation class? Because it sounds like the kind of thing that has a lot of potential to be really engaging, but if the right structures aren't in place, it also sounds like it could be kind of chaotic. So what did you do to set up your class so that students actually do learn and innovate and get a lot done? And what does that look like?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I talk to a lot of teachers out there that they try Genius Hour 20% time for a little bit, and then they're really frustrated. And a couple of things, you know, I talked about the fact that we've trained our students to be subservient and listen. And when you give them choice and some freedom, it's hard for them to take. The other thing is some of the parameters, and by all means, I learned the hard way the first couple of years myself. But I think that when you have them grow their own digital brand, they're not just wanting to, I mean, if they disappoint their teacher, that's one thing. But when they start to blog, and I have them blog every Friday on some of their findings, well, they start building an audience. So if they start mailing it in and not doing that well, okay, you're going to get a bad grade from Mr. Wetrick. Okay, they can deal with that. But then they start hearing back from people. Hey, what happened to your research on this? What happened to that connection you were supposed to make this week? And I think that's a really nice piece, because they start taking it seriously. And by the way, I think this is also a great way to teach digital citizenship. You know, our students are really engaged online, and they're very, very active on Twitter. And you'll never, and quote me on this, you will never find a Don Wetrick innovation student making a fool of him or herself on Twitter, because they're collaborating with some of the best people out there. And talk about a comparative advantage that they have. While some other students are making really bad decisions online and taking selfies and things that are just questionable, my students are wanting to connect with some of the nation's best minds. And I think, you know, with all the structure we have and trying to connect with people, that's kind of a way for them to inspire to do better. But I will say, when you do open up a little bit of freedom and provide this for a class, it's going to be bumpy at first. There is kind of a freak out point where it's a lot easier to be told what to do than it is to say, hey, I'm going to give you a week or so to find out something that you want to learn or that you're passionate about. And there's, I can't tell you how many times I've had students in tears almost saying, I don't know what I'm passionate about. I don't know what I want to learn. We get through that, but I think that's also hitting on a greater problem. When students really don't know what they want to do or what they're passionate about, or even have an inkling on what they want to learn, we have to have a serious discussion. Because when these kids get out of college, it's not like they're going to await instructions. You know, hey, get out there and seize life, as opposed to, okay, I'm now going to wait for somebody to tell me what job I have. No. That doesn't really happen anymore. So that's also why I think this kind of structure, this kind of class is vital.
Well, and I really appreciate the emphasis on both student choice. So students are kind of forced to think about and choose based on what they're passionate about. But also, you ask your students to link their choices to the Common Core standards. So it's almost the opposite of kind of a goof-off class, which from the description, you know, it could kind of go that way if it's not run the right way. But you've taken a very purposeful approach in linking what students are doing, or requiring students to link what they're doing to the standards, and making meaningful connections to outside experts and having a public audience so that their work is something that they're proud of, something they're accountable for, and something that builds skills that transfer into their work as adults.
The first year went smooth. The second year was a little bit dicier. The third year and fourth have been superior, but it wasn't perfect. I've gotten to this point because we've crafted it. There were some students that treated it like a study hall. There were some students that, and some of these kids had 4.0 GPAs, and they were telling me, just tell me to write an essay, I'll do a good job, because they froze. I've since learned, I mean, like, you know, I'm a lifelong learner too. I've since learned how to start the class. When I just set them free on day one, some of these students that were really passionate had these really great, big, huge, audacious goals. And I never realized that a really great project should start off with a 2 to 3 week feasibility and data collection. You know, a feasibility study to find out whether you really can do it. You know, what they wanted to bring some change into the school, that's great. Can it be done? How much red tape is involved? You know, case in point, I had a student, she was just fantastic girl. She was a really good athlete, had scholarship opportunities everywhere, but her brother had pretty severe Down syndrome. she saw an inspirational piece on Real Sports with Brian Gumbel, and it was on the Miracle League, how there were some leagues out there for handicapped and disabled athletes. And she's like, I want to start that in our town. Well, that's a great idea. But as she kept getting further into it, she didn't know that she had to have basically legal counsel, that she had to have waivers, that she had to find a field that they would agree to do this, that she'd have to find, you know, sponsorship, that she'd have to have the blessings of the family, the support of the family. She kept getting deeper and deeper. And all she really wanted to do was just to host a couple of softball games for the kids. And about it was past Christmas, I think. She'd worked on this half a year, and she realized this was never going to get off the ground in the year's time. And then finally she's like, you know what? I'm just going to host something here at the school instead of starting an entire organization. And you know what? That should have been the first step. So that's why on the first 6 weeks of our innovation class, we go through creativity exercises. We go through innovation exercises. We watch TED Talks. But we also learned about how to effectively start a project first. Feasibility, working backwards, talking to your end users, getting data collection, do observing, you know, classic D-school stuff that I've learned better. So I will fully admit, my first at least two years were kind of successful. But each year it gets a little bit better. And quite frankly, and this is my shameless plug, that's kind of why I also wrote the book. Got a book out, Pure Genius. You already talked about it, Building a Culture of Innovation. I wanted to be candid about what we did, but then also glean our mistakes and show where we went wrong and how to do it better. Because I'm really, really, really hoping that my students can showcase how this can be accomplished. They're on display here, and I'm really proud of them. But I wanted to include some of the mistakes as well as the successes.
Well, and Don, I think one of the most critical things that you did in the process was to force students to really think deeply about what they're passionate about and to think about what they want to do about that, because that's essentially the same choice they're facing as young adults when trying to decide on a career. And I think you're absolutely right. So many people go through college with the major that they're kind of supposed to have and get the job that they're supposed to get after majoring in the thing that they're supposed to major in, and get into the workforce, get into the real world, and think, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? This isn't what I wanted. And when we do such a good job of teaching students to be compliant, I think that's kind of a side effect that we really have to take ownership of. And Seth Godin had a book out a couple years ago called Stop Stealing Dreams. I think he is a little hard on educators for teaching students to be compliant, because certainly there are valuable aspects to teaching students compliance, but we don't want to do that at the expense of teaching students to think for themselves, to care about what matters most to them, and to pursue those passions with some vigor. And I think that's a huge life lesson that you've gifted your students with, to throw them into that struggle and force them to ask themselves, what really matters to me? What do I want to make a difference in?
Well, and it's funny you mentioned Seth Godin. I think a lot of times I find a lot of inspiration and ideas from the Seth Godins of the world, Dan Pink. I was just going to quote Lean Startup. I mean, in finding your passion, I expect you to fail early and often. You know, I reward failure in here, or at least I tolerate it. Because if you're going to tell me you want to do a 7 week project and your first project is to do a 2 week study on whether it's really going to go or not, that's worth it. Now, some people are like, oh my gosh, you wasted your time. No, you didn't. You spent 2 weeks realizing that it's not going to work as opposed to 9 weeks. That's awesome. I wish I would have had my internship earlier in my college career, because I realized I didn't like it. So, I don't want to scare people off and say, hey, we love failure at the innovation class, because people look at you like you're crazy, but we do. You know, one of my favorite Disney films ever was Meet the Robinsons. You know, whenever they fail, they're like, yay, that's awesome. You know what not to do next time. And that's exactly the approach we take. Hey, I'm going to do this. You know, one of my students said, hey, I want to start a Spanish class at our elementary. And I didn't want to tell him that there's no way possible. So after a couple of days, he's like, oh, so I talked to some people and I didn't realize that I can't make administration decisions because I don't pay the teachers. And I was like, yeah, I knew that, but I wanted you to figure it out. I mean, that's a great idea. Hey, I want there to be an opportunity for kids to learn how to speak Spanish in grade two. Well, who doesn't? But guess what? You don't have the decisions to make to hire another teacher. So I loved his passion, and he found out that he can't do that. But what might he do? He might be able to see if there are some people that want to volunteer time to do it as a club, things like that. So, you know, all these books we're talking about, you know, Linchpin or Lean Startup or Drive and all these things, I encourage a lot of teachers, man, there are so many ideas and there's so many fresh takes you can get from people that are professional marketers and just people that truly think on the innovative side. And if I can also add, I'm a big fan of Tina Seelig from Stanford's D School and also an innovation leader. She's got a book out, Ingenious. And, you know, and honestly, our class, they're on our Mount Rushmore. We think that the Kelly brothers are about the coolest thing. They run IDEO, Tom and David Kelly. Anything you want to pick up, that Creative Confidence is a new book or a somewhat new book. Highly encourage teachers to read that as well. I get more inspiration out of that than I do the traditional stuff that I still enjoy reading, but it's really great to get a fresh perspective out there other than from educators.
So Don, one thing I think people may be wondering is, you know, if I've already got a packed syllabus, if I have a subject and a set of standards that I need to kind of cover in the course of a year and time is already tight, how can I fit Genius Hour into that? How can I make a full fifth of my class time available for students to pursue their passions, you know, and still get everything done that we need to? What does that look like in a typical subject area?
I think that taking a fresh, innovative approach is always a good idea. Any subject you have, you can have your students connect outside your class. You know, people talk about the flipped classroom. You totally flip your classroom. You might have your students research some of the ways they can improve. They find experts that might help them in their area of study. You know, if you're a math teacher, you might look for some sources of inspiration out there that you can tie into the class. That's why I'm really, really big fan of teachers connecting online and finding these people. You have some of the students do what I was talking about on the self-assessment. When you provide, you know, of course you're going to have to cover, you know, tests and some of the traditional things. But when you say, hey, side project within this area that we were studying, let's find ways to construct this. Let's find ways to express our learning other than a Scantron. I say all these things, and really, let's just also get to the heart of the matter. I hope that you have a supportive administration. This is always the hard part of the conversation. I get people that I talk to, and they're really nice, and they want to do this, and they said, but my administration doesn't believe in this. My administration thinks that the be-all, end-all is what they get on their state assessments, in which case, that's a tough go. But you know, I do think that there's something okay with sometimes not asking for permission, but going forth and trying out some project-based learning and trying out having your students find some great mentors and collaborators. I have a feeling that even some of the toughest administrators out there, when they see results, when they see your students working with really helpful, transformative mentors, I doubt if they're going to say, hey, that's bad. That's wrong. So, you know, I don't want to get anybody fired out there, but sometimes it's worth the risk and you should try it.
Well, and I think there are lots of different ways to kind of frame something like that. If the first words out of your mouth are, hey, you know, I'm not going to teach on Fridays anymore because we're doing Genius Hour, I think that's going to get a different reception than, hey, we're doing these projects that connect students with experts and with real audiences and allow them to solve real problems. And here's how it's gone so far. I think that's a terrific starting point. And that's kind of what you've provided in the book, isn't it? Kind of working model and examples from your classroom?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And for that matter, I wholeheartedly believe this. If your passion and your excitement and enthusiasm spills over, I've seen a lot more yeses than nos. So I think it's worth a try. Yeah, in my book, I talk a lot about how you can start this. I also kind of go into how you train your students to, I think one of the things I didn't mention is how you train your students to find their own opportunities. You know, again, we talked about subservient students sitting and waiting for me to say something. It's not about me. It's about you actively seizing on your opportunities. And that's the thing that I love, is that all of a sudden this moment of realization on my students' faces, oh my gosh, I could do this. And so when they are out there scanning, you know, whether it be on StumbleUpon or going and finding, you know, key sources of inspiration, Fast Company magazine, Wired, whatever, all of a sudden they're like, I could tie, it's what Tina Seelig at Stanford calls collecting and connecting. They collect all these ideas and sources of inspiration and they connect them together. And when they're out there seeking their own opportunities, they know how to bring the value to the class. Hey, I've got to learn this math concept. I know a lot better way to go about this than you've ever thought of. And as the teacher, I have to swallow my pride and go, wow, I never thought of that. You're right. But that's okay. Let go. It's not top down anymore. It's grassroots. If you enable them and you empower them to help dictate some of their own education, good things happen. But don't give up right away when it doesn't happen overnight. We have trained our students to wait for instructions. It will happen. You got to get there. Have patience.
So Don, if you had your way and you could get administrators to kind of all do a certain thing to advance this idea of Genius Hour or 20% time, what would you have school administrators do? And that's our audience at Principal Center Radio. So speaking directly to administrators, what would you like administrators to do?
Do a hashtag search. Look at the examples out there. Yeah, I'm going to throw out some names. Joy Kerr. Chief among them. There's a guy I haven't connected with, but I see some of his stuff, Kevin Brookhauser. There's just people, AJ Giuliani. There's a lot of people out there that are like championing this cause. Follow me on Twitter. And I don't mean that in a self-serving way, because most of my tweets are about my students, especially now that pitch day is coming up soon, and my students are going to start really rolling out their projects. Take a look at what my students do. They know to use the hashtags Genius Hour and 20% time, even though that's technically not our class. Take a look at what's out there. If you want to model and be the, if you want to model some of your school to transform and really want to be the best, I really think that some of these schools that are allowing the opportunity and taking a chance, they're showing what they can do. I think that's why I'm really blessed. I'm at Noblesville High School, just outside of Indianapolis. The school wants to be relevant nationally, and they realize it's nice that moms and dads and aunts and uncles think that we're doing a good job in the school, but it's even better when we can showcase what we're doing here and really kind of relax the fears of some administrators saying, oh, can't bad things happen if you do this? Sure they can. You know, Eric Schettinger was the guy, as a principal, has said, get out your phones and put on Twitter what you're doing at school today. I'm sure there was administrators everywhere looking at him like his hair was on fire and like, what? Yeah. I trust you. Get out Twitter. Let me know what you're doing in class. Be transparent. And I think that's my last point that I am so passionate about. Transparency is everything. You want to know what's going on in my class? I update everything on my YouTube account. We have an NHS Innovations page on YouTube. Every week, we give updates. What we did wrong, what we did right, what some of the projects are going to be this year. It eases fears. Parents know what we're doing. Other schools might be inspired. Of course, we also might be scaring people away. When I'm candid about our mistakes, maybe that makes people go, aha, I told you.
So the book is Pure Genius, Building a Culture of Innovation and Taking 20% Time to the Next Level. Don, thanks so much for sharing what's worked so well in your classroom after lots of trial and error and lots of bumps in the road to figure out what we can do as educators to kind of unlock those opportunities for students to pursue what they're passionate about and solve real world problems.
Thank you for having me on. Side note, if anybody wants to get a hold of me, you can always email me with any questions or any help you need, dwetrick@gmail.com, or I'm on Twitter all the time at Don Wetrick.
And now, Justin Bader on High Performance Instructional Leadership.
So, high performance instructional leaders, what did you take away from my interview with Don? One thing I hope that we can all commit to after hearing Don's story of trying things and iterating and struggling and realizing that things weren't working as well as he had hoped the first time, and then hearing how he persevered through that and tried some more things and really saw his career as an 18-year veteran educator, not as 1 year of teaching repeated 18 times, but as a continual learning process. I hope that gives us some confidence in the ability of our teachers to experiment and to innovate. And I think too often we make decisions that are driven by fear, that are driven by a desire to make sure that all the bases are covered. And I think that's rational for people in our position. We're responsible for ensuring that the right things take place. And an unfortunate side effect of that pursuit of responsibility on our part is that too often we say no to too many things. We want to ensure that the right things happen, and we go overboard in ensuring that other things don't happen. Things like experimentation, things like using time in unconventional ways that we think might be wasteful, but they could also be incredibly productive and incredibly rewarding. So I hope you've been inspired by the success of Don's students, and we'll share some examples on the show page on our website at principalcenter.com, where you can see what Don's students are up to. And if you're interested in bringing this idea to your school, get the book, take a look at how it's worked for Don, but don't try it with all of your teachers at once. One thing I really want to implore you to do is find the right people who are passionate about this, who are willing to experiment, not afraid to try new things, and excited about sharing what they learn from that process. One more thing I took away from my talk with Don was the importance of reading outside of education. And Don and I have both recently read the book, The Lean Startup, which is a terrific book on how to innovate using short iterative cycles. And I learn a ton from books from the business world, from the software world, from psychology, all kinds of different fields, I think have a tremendous amount to do with the complex work that we do working with students and teachers every day. So read widely, don't be afraid to take risks, and when you have staff members who want to try something new, say yes, give them the support they need, and see what happens.
Thanks for listening to Principal Center Radio. For more great episodes, subscribe on our website at principalcenter.com/radio.